In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Britain was caught up by a new craze. A craze for contacting the dead. One of the most enthusiastic proponents of spiritualism was someone who you might not expect, Arthur Conan Doyle, the author best known for creating the arch-rationalist Sherlock Holmes. Conan Doyle's adventures into the realms of the supernatural took him from seances to encounters with fairies and fights with Harry Houdini. Historians Fiona Snailam and Anna Maria Barry wrote about this story for BBC History Magazine earlier this year, and I spoke to them to find out more. The first person you'll hear after me is Fiona. So thank you both very much for joining me. It's nice to be speaking to you. We're going to be discussing today how the Sherlock Holmes creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, became drawn into the world of spiritualism. Conan Doyle, I think, is remembered by a lot of people as the creator of literature's most rational figure, which doesn't seem initially to tally with the idea of the supernatural and contacting the dead. How did he reconcile these two ideas in his life?
Sherlock Holmes is a rational searcher of evidence, one might say. But to a certain extent, so was Arthur Conan Doyle when it came to spiritualism. He left his Christian faith behind because he didn't feel that it presented tangible evidence in any way, shape or form. Whereas to him, over the course of his later life, spiritualism did. You can track tangible evidence in tables that tilt or slates that are written on by unseen hands and by ectoplasm later in the century. So to him, it was very much a case of there is evidence here, just as Holmes might look for evidence.
So before we delve into how Conan Doyle got involved in the world of spiritualism, let's cover off some bases. When we're looking and talking about spiritualism in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, what can you tell us about that movement?
So spiritualism, I think to go back to the roots of it in mid-19th century, you have to go over to the States and look at the Fox sisters. They're commonly believed to have been the beginning mediums, I suppose, for modern spiritualism. And they were two young sisters, aged 14 and 11, in Hydesville, New York, who had tappings, and they believed that the dead were communicating with them. Over time, they were known locally, and then they went to live with their older sister, Leah, in Rochester, who, shall we say, promoted them as communicators with the dead, and it began to take off. It became more of a craze in the States at that time, and then was brought over to the United Kingdom by two women American mediums in the early 1850s, Mrs. Hayden and Mrs. Roberts, who came over and gave public performances and demonstrations. And then other celebrity mediums started to get involved, including people like Daniel Douglas Hume, who gave public performances to some really wealthy patrons, including the likes of Robert and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. There were investigations. You had the Society for Psychical Research, who were starting to explore the science behind it to see whether they could find tangible evidence. And there were some really famous proponents of it as well. So you had, you know, the evolutionist Alfred Russel Wallace, William Crookes, the chemist, all were proponents of spiritualism. And then you had some other people high up in science, Huxley, for instance, or John Tyndall, who were anti the idea of it, didn't think that it was a tangible practice. That carried on throughout the 19th century. But then as you got to the early 20th century and the onset of war, it became a growth movement once again, as people sought solace in communicating with the dead upon, you know, mass loss of life.
And what drew Conan Doyle particularly to the movement?
Conan Doyle's interest came about initially when he was a young, newly qualified doctor. So earlier on in his career, he did work as a medical doctor. And even though he initially called psychic phenomena the greatest nonsense upon earth, he became interested in it after an experiment in thought transference. So this is something where he and a friend were kind of messing about with this experiment, where they sat with their backs to each other and one of them would draw a picture on a piece of paper and try to telepathically communicate it to the other. And while kind of playing about with this exercise, Conan Doyle was really amazed to see that time and time again, they had managed to pass this message seemingly telepathically. So he began to research psychic phenomena around the world. He was a very widely read man, and he became fascinated with the idea that people in very different cultures from very different backgrounds and different religions had reported similar phenomena in different parts of the world in different times. And he started to become really interested. So he joined the Society for Psychical Research that Fiona mentioned in the 1890s. And at the time, the president was a man called Arthur Balfour, who later became the British Prime Minister. So it just goes to show that the people that were involved in this society, they weren't a load of out there fringe people that had this strange interest. They were scientists, psychologists, chemists, natural historians that had a really big interest in really thoroughly and rigorously testing claims, weeding out fraudulent mediums and people who, you know, relied on trickery to take advantage of people. So I suppose that's where we see the kind of synergy with the Sherlock Holmes character and the really rational process of trying to deduce, you know, what was going on.
And Conan Doyle wasn't only drawn in by the psychical evidence that he thought he saw, was he? He had a personal reason, really, for turning to spiritualism, didn't he?
He did. So he was one of many people who lost a close relation, actually several close relations, in the First World War. And for him, it was his son, Kingsley. So Kingsley died during the First World War. And as I've said, Conan Doyle had already had this existing interest in visiting mediums and exploring psychic phenomena before the First World War, but it was really a turning point for him when he lost his son. And he, on one occasion in 1919, attended a seance with a Welsh medium called Evan Powell. And it was at this seance that his son came through, or he perceived that his son came through and communicated with him. He said that he was very, very happy on the other side and even apparently kissed his father's head. And that for him was a real turning point. He was absolutely convinced from that point on that there was something in this. And from this point onwards, he became the world's foremost proponent of spiritualism and its best known public defender.
At around the time Anna's talking about, when he made first communication with Kingsley through the Welsh medium, his wife's live-in companion, Lily, also developed mediumship skills of her own, having lost her own brother in the war. So there's a household that becomes almost fixated with contacting those they've lost in the war. And it becomes a situation in which all of them are starting to use that as a form of solace from communicating with multiple different members of extended family, really.
And to set that in a wider context as well, in 1919, there was a public spiritualist service at the Royal Albert Hall, at which 7,000 people attended. And it was billed as a joyous reunion with the fallen soldiers of the First World War. So that gives you just some kind of idea of the scale of this belief. Again, it wasn't a sort of strange fringe thing. It was very much in the mainstream. I mean, there was a spiritualist press. There were more than one spiritualist newspaper that you could buy to read all about latest developments and latest investigations. It wasn't just a kind of niche interest. This was something that was really widespread and discussed in the papers. And, you know, everybody knew about this.
That idea of a seance being billed as a joyous reunion is really interesting, because I think quite often now, if you said the word seance to somebody, they would think of something spooky and haunting. But if we'd have gone to one of these performances, these seances, whatever you want to call them, what would that experience have been like?
It depends on whether one attended a private seance or a public demonstration. I think we have to contextualize it like that. Public demonstrations were very widely attended and occurred in large spaces. Church halls were quite often used to host these occasions, and the mediums would be up on stage passing messages or raps or giving evidence on stage from afar to the watching audience. In a private seance, it would be a much smaller affair, perhaps around a table, often in the dark, because mediums said that spirits didn't like the light. When people were watching them, they were slightly shy, perhaps. Although there were closed door private seance experiments carried out where mediums did ask watching investigators to tie them to chairs in a way of proving that they weren't manipulating items of furniture with their own limbs or anything like that.
Well, that's an important point to make, isn't it? That, of course, there were skeptics who went after the spiritualist movement. What were some of the criticisms that they levelled against it, and what were some of their claims about the trickery involved in the spiritualist movement?
Okay, so the most famous debunker of spiritualism was actually Harry Houdini, the famous escapologist. So in the 1910s, he was dazzling the world with all of his tricks, kind of wriggling out of restraints when suspended over Manhattan and entombed in coffins, and from the Hudson River, I think he managed to get out of a box that was chucked into the river. But he also had an interest in spiritualism, which was something he initially kept quite quiet, because it had a very personal poignance for him, because he'd lost his mother, who he was particularly close to. And he had this sort of vested interest, I suppose, in trying to find out whether he might be able to communicate with her. And he eventually, in the 1920s, began a correspondence with Arthur Conan Doyle, who was at this point, obviously, a very well-known proponent of spiritualism. And they eventually met up, and they had this correspondence where they would talk about, you know, their beliefs and whether or not certain mediums were legitimate, and how people maybe pulled the wool over the eyes of the public. And they had all of these interesting debates. But there was an incident involving Conan Doyle's wife, Lady Jean, who was herself a medium, as Fiona said, who practiced automatic writing. And she did a reading for Houdini on one occasion, in which she claimed to be in contact with his mother on the other side. And she wrote this letter for Houdini that was supposed to be from his mother. And Houdini became quite suspicious, because the letter was in English when his mother in life only ever spoke Hungarian. So things started to kind of sour a little bit between the two men. And over time, as certain cases of particular mediums received a lot of attention in the press, they were sort of billed as opponents. So you had, on the one hand, Conan Doyle, who was the great champion and cheerleader of the spiritualist cause. And on the other hand, you had Houdini, who set himself up as the world's most famous debunker. And I think both of them were as biased as each other, because at this point in his career, Houdini was a much older man. He couldn't do the kind of physical escapology that he kind of built his reputation on. So he was relying more and more on billing himself as a debunker. And it was actually part of his performance to demonstrate to the audience the sorts of tricks that mediums used to fool spiritualists and believers. That kind of became part of his show. So it set up this big rivalry between Conan Doyle and Houdini, who often slammed each other in the press and were really quite vicious and scathing about each other publicly, but who actually behind the scenes remained quite cordial, and their correspondence was actually quite respectful, despite the fact that they were great rivals in another sense.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And Arthur Conan Doyle was actually completely taken in, to such an extent that in 1922, so 100 years ago this year, he actually wrote a book about the fairies, where in which he came out and said that he believed in them. They were evidence of, you know, worlds that we don't understand. And he included all sorts of details on what he imagined fairies would eat, what their relationships would be like with each other.
So So skeptics like Houdini, who were hard at work trying to disprove some of the medium's techniques, what kind of stuff did they uncover? What kind of tricks did mediums get up to?
Well, one of the Fox sisters, towards the end of her life, actually confessed for a very short period of time before recanting the confession that it had all been a hoax. And in disguise and under a pseudonym, she actually went on stage to reveal some of her own tricks, which involved kind of knuckle and joint cracking. And I just personally can't imagine being able to crack one's knuckles to quite the extent that it would be convincing.
To a hall full of people as well. That must have been really loud.
So that was one trick that was confessed by a medium who then later said that the spirits had told her that she ought to say that it had all been a hoax, but of course it hadn't really, by which point she'd lost all integrity and nobody believed them whatsoever. There were other tricks that were uncovered. The Reverend Dr. Monks, who claimed to have teleported himself from Bristol to Swindon at one point, was investigated. And in the darkened seance room, some sort of wire with cheesecloth was found. So he'd been creating this ectoplasm in the dark, but actually it was just kind of sort of cloth and wire.
Beyond Houdini, how did other people view Conan Doyle's adventures in the world of spiritualism?
So one particular incident that Conan Doyle did receive a lot of criticism for is the case of the Cottingley Fairies, which I think is quite well known. So this is the story that began in 1917 in the Yorkshire village of Cottingley, where two young cousins who were aged just 9 and 16 years old claimed to have taken photos of fairies in their garden. And the spiritualist world got to hear about these photos, and Arthur Conan Doyle got to hear about them, and he became really, really fascinated and sort of seized on them. And he took them out to a number of experts to analyze the photos and see whether they could figure out how the girls might have created these faked photographs. Obviously, there was no Photoshop at this time, but there were different ways with, you know, double exposures that you might create a fake image. And the experts were actually bamboozled, which is, you know, quite amazing when you think one of these girls was 9 years old. And Arthur Conan Doyle was actually completely taken in to such an extent that in 1922, so 100 years ago this year, he actually wrote a book about the fairies, where in which he came out and said that he believed in them. They were evidence of, you know, worlds that we don't understand. And he included all sorts of details on what he imagined fairies would eat, what their relationships would be like with each other. When this book was published, as you might expect, Arthur Conan Doyle was pretty well savaged in the press, and people thought he was a bit of an old fool, that he'd been taken in with the fairies, and he was really lampooned and took a lot of criticism for this. But, you know, he really had the courage of his convictions, and he completely stuck by his belief, even though much later on, when the girls were in their 80s, I think, they did to some extent admit that the images had been faked. I think they said that they'd cut pictures out of storybooks and drawn fairies and attached them to blades of grass with pins. So that's why the images did seem like they were real live moving creatures, because they were pinned to the grass and there was some sort of movement in the images. Although one of the girls did insist that they had actually seen fairies, and even though the majority of photos were faked, she maintained until her death that one of them was a genuine photo. So you never know, maybe Conan Doyle wasn't too far wrong.
No, so I was just going to say that for all he was ridiculed later on about things like the fairies, he was seen as quite threatening by members of the church earlier. So Anna mentioned a few moments ago about the remembrance service that the spiritualist movement held for the fallen in the war. It really got the goat of the Bishop of London, who then held his own remembrance service, attended by many ex-servicemen, almost in opposition and defiance of the spiritualist movement doing so, and wrote an article that was reported in the Times shortly afterwards, stating that it was a sin to be trying to communicate with the dead. And whilst there were reports of sons appearing to their mothers, all that showed was that after death, the spirit carried on, the soul carried on, and that nobody should try to communicate with the dead, and that people, quote, like Arthur Conan Doyle, should just be left to get on with it. So he did rile some feathers quite high up in the church, and there were exchanges in the press and the spiritualist press, particularly Light, a periodical for spiritualists, about this, in which Arthur Conan Doyle reversed the bishop's reasoning and accusations and said all the bishop was doing was acknowledging that the church also believed that there was some kind of spiritual life, and that that spiritualists themselves agreed with the church that nobody should be forcing communication, but that if the spirits wish to get in touch, nobody should be stopping it.
What do you think that all this debate and discussion about spiritualism, psychical evidence, contacting the dead, tells us about the time?
I think it depends the time you're looking at. In the kind of mid to late 19th century, you're looking at a time of transition between church and science, and sort of faith versus reasoning and empirical evidence. And that spiritualism really is a reflection of that, and it's attacked from both angles. I think once you start looking at it from the point of view of the war, it's grieving people trying to find anything to hold on to. And I don't think, as from a human perspective, that's something that we're that far away from anyway. That when you lose people and when you're living in a time of grief and trauma, that's something that we do look towards.
And I think, you know, another interesting thing to consider is that spiritualism hasn't gone away. It's still a religion. There are spiritualist churches all across the country. I know Fiona and I have spoken, and both of us as teenagers, and we were interested in this sort of thing. Both of us have visited to kind of see what it's all about. And this is something that, you know, I would imagine that a lot of listeners will probably have a spiritualist church not too far from their house. It didn't end with the First World War. It's still very much a live religion. And the societies that we're talking about, the Society for Psychical Research and the College of Psychic Studies in London, they're still going, still active. They're still, you know, organizations that exist today.
Yeah, the Spiritualist National Union was formed on principles actually proposed by a 19th century spiritualist, and they've got 300 churches, according to their website, 2,500 active members still today. So as Anna says, this is still quite a big area of practicing faith.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about an incident in which it could be said that Conan Doyle's death didn't mean the end of his involvement in spiritualism. I wonder if one of you would be able to share that story with us.
So Conan Doyle died in July 1930. And as you say, Ellie, it wasn't necessarily the end. His widow, Lady Jean, who was practicing medium herself, took it upon herself and members of the family to organise a séance at the Royal Albert Hall to communicate with the late Sir Arthur. There were a series of different mediums present on stage and an absolutely packed auditorium. After giving several eulogies, and Mrs. Estelle Roberts, a very famous practicing medium at the time, claimed that Sir Arthur was there present in evening dress and had left a message for his wife. She went over and she spoke to Lady Jean and passed on the message, but it was never revealed what was said. The only thing that was expressed in the press from Lady Doyle was that it had been a communication from her husband.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Husband, and that she was quite happy that he had indeed been there and present.
That was Fiona Snailham and Anna Maria Barry. You can find their feature on Conan Doyle's Adventures in Spiritualism online at historyextra.com if you search for Conan Doyle Supernatural. Fiona Snailham is an early career researcher with a focus on 19th century literature and Victorian spiritualism. Anna Maria Barry is a historian and writer specialising in 19th century culture. Her current research focuses on death masks. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.